Selma and the events that are going on in Birmingham, the Freedom Rides, the sit-ins of the early 60s, it really lessens the impact and the totality of his activism, right? So what's interesting for me is that doing the research on Stokely, you really got a better sense of how important an activist he was and the legacy of the activism, both as a civil rights militant and a black power a revolutionary, but somebody who has a deep relationship with Martin Luther King Jr., but somebody who's really articulating, along with SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, the deepest criticism against the Vietnam War in 1966, who's popularizing the term not just black power, but hell no, we won't go, and who provides a blueprint for the kind of anti-imperialism that people like King and the Black Panthers and Students for a Democratic Society and other folks are going to articulate. But it's really, you know, Stokely and his activism that really are the linchpin of that, and that's been lost historically.
Well, I want to thank you, because half day I'm a third grade teacher, and the other half of the day I'm the school librarian, and you have given me a hero to introduce the students to. So I really thank you. I understand that he started at a pretty young age, about 19.
Oh, yeah. You know, what's interesting is he was first arrested at 19, but he was an activist earlier than that. So he comes to the United States 2 weeks before his 11th birthday. And what's interesting is that he moves to a predominantly white section of the Bronx called Morris Park. So Stokely and his family, he's got four sisters, his mother, May Charles, and his father, Adolphus. So he's raised in a tight-knit family. He's got both parents there. He is a very precocious student. You know, one of the big things with Carmichael is that he tests into Bronx Science High School, and that was a very prestigious school, and he tests into that school before affirmative action. So he's one of eight African Americans or black folks who are in a class of over 300 in the class of 1960, and you have to test into that. There's an all-day exam when you're in the eighth grade. And so he's one of the few people who gets into that school. And Bronx Science is predominantly white, predominantly Jewish. He becomes friends with these sons and daughters of liberals and left-wing activists. One of his best friends, Gene Dennis, is the son of a high-ranking Communist Party official. So what's interesting is that he becomes politicized through multiple traditions. One is going to be a predominantly white left tradition. Another is going to be a black socialist or social democratic tradition coming out of Bayard Rustin, who's the pacifist, anti-war activist, a mentor to Martin Luther King Jr., and the organizer of the March on Washington. And another is a pan-Africanist tradition through going to Harlem and listening to black street speakers talk about Kwame Nkrumah, talk about Sekou Touré. He's listening to Miriam Makeba, who he later marries in 1968 when he's a teenager. So unlike most students who become part of the sit-in movement, he's political by the time he enters Howard University. He's been organizing garment workers. He's been organizing in Harlem. He's been, you know, in demonstrations throughout New York City, but sometimes away from New York, Fair Play for Cuba Committee, anti-nuclear proliferation rallies. So it's very interesting. So he's political and an intellectual and an activist at 17, 18, 19 years old. And I think it's remarkable, and we usually don't give black people credit, as you all know, for being intellectuals, right? We say the white people think and the black people are the bodies. They do. We're the animals, the savages, and you see it in 12 Years a Slave. Carmichael Kwame Ture is an intellectual, but he's also an activist.
And yet
so that's what's so important.
But later on in life, he was criticized for being an intellectual or an ideologue, and that, you know, he wasn't being practical enough. But people said that when he went to Guinea, that he abandoned the more practical activism and was just somebody who was chasing a dream. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I think leaving to Guinea, we have to talk about what happened before. So if you look at between 60 and 68, the big thing is that for 8 years, and he had been an activist as a teenager, he is doing, for 6 of those years, he's doing nonviolent activism. He's a sit-in demonstrator. He goes to Howard University from 60 to 64, but at Howard, he's part of the Nonviolent Action Group. He's doing protests. in Washington, D.C. He's meeting up with Caribbean and African leaders and students at the embassies in Washington. And this is all as a teenager. He goes to Mississippi for the first time in 1961. He's arrested as a freedom rider and spends 40 days in Parchman Penitentiary, Mississippi's worst prison farm, at the age of 19. He spends his 20th birthday in prison, and he's going to be arrested 27 times between June 8, 1961 and June 16, 1966. So all these experiences are hugely important. He spends every summer in Mississippi organizing. He becomes good friends with Bob Moses, the organizer of in SNCC, who's in Greenwood, Mississippi, in Macomb, Mississippi, and the architect of the Summer Project, or Freedom Summer, where they bring white volunteers to help an indigenous black or African community in Mississippi protest for social, political justice, for civil rights, for anti-racism. So all those things are you know, part of who he is. So initially he's organizing for radical democracy, and he defines radical democracy as democracy where poor black sharecroppers are running things, where they have the power. And he does this because of the influence of women like Ella Baker, who's the organizer of the Student Nonviolent Coordinated Committee, who had been a labor organizer, who was from North Carolina, had been a long marcher by the time she organizes SNCC. She's 57 years old, who says that strong people don't need strong leaders. She's against hierarchies of all kinds. He's influenced by Fannie Lou Hamer, the sharecropper from Ruleville, Mississippi, who becomes a SNCC activist and the organizer of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. So all these things really are going to lead him to break by 64 in a way with the mainstream civil rights movement. Because by 64, when SNCC tries to organize a Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party to sit in at the Democratic National Convention and be seated delegates, they're going to be thwarted in that attempt by Lyndon Johnson, the President of the United States. And Fannie Lou Hamer has the famous Credentials Committee testimony that's live, where she talks about black people being beaten and abused and murdered in Mississippi because she says, we want to be treated like decent human beings. And she has the line where she says she questions America. And Lyndon Johnson calls a hasty press conference to stop the television cameras from seeing this black woman from Mississippi tell everybody the truth about white supremacy in America. So these are all things that Stokely experiences on the ground. So the big thing, when everybody was saying, the critics who said he wasn't being practical by the time he leaves for Africa, they weren't on the ground doing any political organizing.
Okay. You know, mentioning being on the ground, the groundwork you did in terms of research for this entails looking at FBI documents. Could you elaborate a little bit on that, some 20,000 pages?
Yeah, and that was just one part of it. I mean, the FBI documents are really dwarfed by other you know, sources in their own way, but they're a big source. The FBI documents through the Freedom of Information Act are just some of the documents that they've released. So there's other documents that are still classified, but they're important in the way in which they show that, you know, Kwame Ture, Stokely Carmichael, was being, you know, illegally surveilled and harassed for decades and decades. Beginning earlier than 66, they had a file as early as 64, but by the time he calls for black power, you know, they're trying to charge him with sedition, they're charging him with treason. He marries Miriam Makeba in 1968. They're surveilling both of them. They're trying to say that Carmichael is a CIA agent and that he is working for the government in hopes of triggering a political assassination. I mean, so it's really hugely dangerous stuff. But one thing I'll say, it's important to get that it's not just the FBI. It's the entire U.S. National intelligence infrastructure is surveilling him. So sometimes when you talk about the FBI, it lets the State Department off the hook and the Justice Department off the hook, the White House, the CIA, the UIS, which is the United States Information Services, and the USIA, United States Information Agency. So all these folks are connected to surveillance. And then there's local police departments. In New York, you had the Bureau of Special Services, but there's local police departments in every city in America and local state agencies. So the Mississippi Sovereignty Committee is also surveilling Carmichael. And Mississippi Sovereignty Committee, that was Mississippi's illegal FBI kind of surveillance. So it's really a huge panoramic of state-sanctioned intelligence agencies. And when he goes to Paris, he's under surveillance. When he goes to Cuba, wherever he goes. So it's bigger than J. Edgar Hoover and COINTELPRO counterintelligence program, although that's a part of it.
Would you talk a little bit about the relationship that Stokely Carmichael had with Dr. King?
Yeah, they have a really complicated relationship, but a real tremendous friendship. In a way, they come to regard each other really as family more than friends. And Stokely had first met Dr. King at Howard University in 1963, and I think it's important, their relationship, because even though Stokely in certain ways patterns himself after Malcolm, had met Malcolm in 61 when he came to Howard University to debate Bayard Rustin, had seen Malcolm and run into him in Washington, D.C. when Malcolm became minister of the Muslim Mosque number 4 in D.C. in the summer of 63. He really is closer personally to Martin Luther King Jr. Because he gets more face time with Dr. King. So when we think about King and Stokely, in 64, when King visits Greenwood for a week, it's Stokely who's chauffeuring King around. In 65, when King is in Selma, Stokely is marching with King in Selma, but Stokely goes away from all the fanfare when they reach Montgomery, and he goes into Lowndes County and starts organizing sharecroppers along with SNCC activists like Judy Richardson and Scott Smith and Bob Mance. And those sharecroppers are going to be the Lowndes County Freedom Organization in 66, and the nickname of that is the Black Panther Party. So it's the community organizing that Stokely does that leads to the original Black Panther Party, and he becomes prime minister of the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense in Oakland. So that's part of that trajectory as well. So when we think about King, by 66, along the Meredith March in Mississippi, James Meredith is the first black student to enroll at the University of Mississippi in 1962, which leads to 3 days of rioting and death in Oxford, Mississippi, because of white supremacists were opposed to desegregating the University of Mississippi. He goes on a one-man march, June 5th, 1966. He's shot on his second day with buckshot. He's not going to be killed, but he's going to be hospitalized, and Dr. King and Stokely and other civil rights leaders are going to go down and continue the march, and that becomes the Meredith March. And SNCC makes a collective decision to unleash black power at that march. So black power, the way in which SNCC is defining it as radical social, political, economic self-determination, gets unleashed during that march. Willie Ricks, Mukasa, is one of the folks who's saying black power. There's different activists who are saying black power instead of freedom now. And even though King and Stokely are going to disagree on the usage of the term black power, they become quite close along the way of that march. And, you know, King invites Stokely to his home for dinner. Stokely's anti-Vietnam War activism really pushes Dr. King on the question of the war. Dr. King's going to come out against the Vietnam War April 4th, 1967, a year to the day before he dies. Or a year to the day of his death, actually. And when we think about King and Stokely, they headline a massive anti-Vietnam War protest April 15, 1967. 400,000 people, the largest anti-war demonstration up until that time. And Stokely really steals the show, calling the Vietnam War a racist war, calling it an imperial war, saying that he's not going to fight in there and that it's connected to poverty and racial segregation and just American empire and imperialism. And afterwards, at Harry Belafonte's apartment, you know, Stokely is teasing Dr. King, saying that it's his activism that's pushing King to come out and speak out more forcefully against the war. And finally,